Governor Scott enters the U.S. Senate race. A constitutional ban on oil drilling is proposed, and Florida hits a marijuana milestone. This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at baycareevents.org.
From the studios at WUSF Public Media, I'm Robin Sessingham. It's our monthly Reporters Roundtable, and here to discuss the topics making news in Florida, William March. He covers politics for the Tampa Bay Times, and Justine Griffin reports on health for the same paper, the Tampa Bay Times. Thank you both for being here.
Hi, Robin.
Thank you.
So William March, Congressman Dennis Ross, thought it was going to be a slow news day when he announced his retirement this month. But Paul Ryan chose that same day to announce that he was leaving, too. Ross is a Republican from Lakeland and will not run for re-election to the 15th congressional district. Why isn't he running again?
That's hard to say. His words were simply that he wanted to spend more time with his family, had never intended to make this a full-time occupation for the rest of his life. And I've seen no reporting, no talk of anything that contradicts what the congressman himself said about his reasons. Congressman Ross's resignation is part of a major rash of resignations of Republican Congress members that included, as you noted, House Speaker Paul Ryan announcing his on the same day. It's thought that a number of these congressmen are worried that the Republicans will lose control of the House. They'll find themselves in a minority party in Congress, which is not nearly as much fun as being in the majority.
Right. So he hasn't said that specifically, but there have been several resignations.
No, I think few or none of the Congress members who have resigned or announced that they'll leave early have actually said that was part of the reason. It's speculated that is part of their reasons.
Okay. So who are some of the front runners right now for that seat?
Well, there's been a mad scramble because Ross's resignation came very soon before the qualifying period, which begins April 30th. So, like I said, a scramble. Two of the front runners would be Ross Spano, who's a state House member from Dover. He was running for attorney general, and he's now dropped out of that race and instead will run for this congressional seat. And a former state House member from Lakeland named Neil Comby. In addition to that, a prominent home builder in Lakeland named Sean Harper is about to announce. And there are a couple of other lesser known candidates. The big question mark is State Senator Tom Lee from Hillsborough County, who's considering it.
So it used to be really a Polk County-centric district.
Oh, yes.
I guess that's changing.
It was Polk County's House seat, basically, for decades, going back to, I guess, the late 70s with Andy Ireland. And it's been held by a Lakeland person since then. And the folks in Polk County are now worried because what happened was the redistricting that took effect in 2016 redrew the district so that just slightly more than half of the voters are in Hillsborough County. Mm. Only about, I think, 30 or 40% are now in Polk County and a few thousand in Lake County. And the folks in Polk County are very worried that they'll lose their only resident congressman, the only member of Congress who actually lives in Polk County. A county that's about to have closing in on 700,000 people, they feel they should have their own resident Congress member.
So I know there was opposition to the way the district was drawn, but to no avail.
Oh, it really angers the folks in Polk County. They've been split up among three congressional districts.
So Justine Griffin, Florida hit a milestone recently for medical marijuana. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So the Department of Health puts out a weekly report just sort of tallying how many patients have been registered with the state, how many physicians are registered with the state, how many dispensaries have opened. And Florida has reached the 100,000 mark in terms of patients. So I think it's a little bit more than that. It's 100,500 patients. What's really interesting is there's only about 1,300 physicians who are registered to treat all those patients.
So how do you register to become a medical marijuana patient?
Sure. So if you are interested in becoming a medical marijuana patient, you have to fall into a specific health categories. So you have to have some type of ailment that that is basically approved by the state to let you use medical marijuana as a treatment. That could be PTSD, that could be chronic pain in some cases, and then it's mostly very serious health conditions like cancer. But your normal primary care physician cannot write you a prescription for medical marijuana. You have to see a specific doctor that is also registered with the state to give a recommendation. And they call it recommendations, not prescriptions, because technically it's still illegal at the federal level to possess or use medical marijuana. So a doctor can only recommend it. And then a patient can take that to a specific dispensing company and fill it, essentially.
So it's still kind of complicated.
It is.
So why is 100,000, why is that a big deal?
That's a lot of patients. So since Amendment 2 passed, it's been sort of a long, slow process to get the industry up and running. But it does show that Floridians are very interested in medical marijuana, at least in trying it. 100,000 people are a lot of people.
Yeah, because this time last year, it was a lot fewer, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, not even close. Also, in the last year and a half or so, or basically when dispensing companies began to open their retail locations. So people have had more access within the last year to see a physician and then actually go to a dispensary.
So now this means that the state is going to release four more licenses that allow a business to cultivate and distribute the drug, right?
Right. The way the state has set it up is more companies will be allowed to basically join the industry, grow, manufacture, open some dispensaries, depending on the level of how many patients there are. So it will grow as more patients sign up.
So they're really trying to keep a handle on it as best they can.
Sure.
Who the patients are, who the doctors, only 1,300 doctors, as you said, and then very specific growers.
Right.
So,
and it's a very tedious process to apply to be a grower.
Right. And there's a lot of appeals.
Sure. There's been a lot
who didn't get it.
Absolutely. And there's been a lot of growing pains, even for the companies that did get it. There are several outstanding lawsuits against the Department of Health. Trulieve, one of the dispensing companies, is one of those who filed a lawsuit. And they are challenging the health department's rules that they're limiting how many dispensaries they can open. And Trulieve wants to open more than the health department will allow them to. So they're suing them in court.
I mean, some of these regulations seem a little arbitrary.
Sure.
To the businesses, I can see why they would think, why not let me open some more dispensaries? I mean, if it's legal, it's legal.
I think the legislature for sure dragged their feet after Amendment 2 passed, and as they tried to figure out how this was going to be legal, how they wanted this to affect Floridians across the state. And I think the system that they've set up, this vertical integration where a company grows the plant, they manufacture it, they have all control over who buys it, their price point, everything, sounded great to politicians at the time. But I think it has not created a free market, I guess. And patients are the ones who seem to be dealing with the barriers that this has created so far.
Kind of ironic in such a Republican-dominated state.
Right?
Yes. So we're going to get back to that a little bit later in the show. But William, once every 20 years, a group meets to look at revising Florida's Constitution. The Constitution Revision Commission finished its work this month, and they did something called bundling, where they put two or three different ideas together under one proposed amendment. Some people thought that was a little sneaky.
You're right. Sneaky, that's a word for it. The stated reason for this is to prevent what they called ballot fatigue, which
right.
is simply having a long, long list of constitutional amendment questions on the ballot. There are still, even with the bundles that you mentioned, there are still going to be 13 amendments on the ballot. The question is, was this bundling done to prevent ballot fatigue, or was it done in order to group these amendments so that perhaps an amendment that the commission wanted passed but might not be popular would be tied to one that would be more popular with voters?
Right. So we had criticisms from liberal groups who said the only reason you're doing this is because these proposals can't stand on their own unless you group it with something more popular. And like you said, the proponents in the commission said, we don't want to have 30 proposals on the ballot. Nobody's going to read all that. There's going to be ballot fatigue, as you called it. But is it a, it's a moot point right now. They're going to go on the ballot bundled the way they are. Give an example of the bundling.
Well, probably the one that's most disliked by liberals or progressives has to do with K-12 education. And what it does is it includes something that's likely to be a popular idea, which is term limits for school board members. But that's bundled with a couple of other things, one of which is increased state control over charter schools. That is, taking some charter schools out from under control of the school district and putting that control in the hands of state government, which is more favorable toward charter schools than a lot of school districts are. And the critics see this as putting a popular idea, which people are likely to vote for, in with an idea that further enhances charter schools to the detriment of public schools in the state.
And even bundles it with an probably even more popular idea, which is to teach civics, to require that civics be taught in high schools.
Again, you're right.
But the charter school one, it would, as you said, it would create a separate entity outside the local school boards that would approve or control charter schools. But what proponents say is good about it is that it would also give them flexibility to set up. It's not just for charter schools. It's for more collegiate high schools, university lab schools. It would set up other innovative schools besides just charter schools.
Yes, but the key point of objection by the critics is that it would give control and supervision of those charter schools to the state rather than to the local school board. They see it as yet another assault on local control of education, yet another attempt by the legislature to centralize power over education in Tallahassee.
Right, and the legislature would see it as an attempt to
foster
innovation, have more choice in school when you've got a very entrenched power system in the public school system that may not want to have a different kind of school from the traditional school that they're already in place.
That's basically the argument, and tying that measure to, as you said, the civics education and term limits for school board members is viewed by some as a way to get this measure passed when it might otherwise fail.
And it has to pass by 60% of voter approval.
Right.
So that's a big hurdle.
Right. And the bundling, to the extent that it becomes a controversy, really, in the view of a lot of people, raises a question about how many of these issues are going to pass. There's some thinking that the bundles are going to be so confusing that people will have a tendency to vote against them out of frustration or confusion, or at least not vote for them.
Just won't vote. They're talking about and just go on to the next thing.
Sure.
Right.
I guess probably the weirdest one is there's a constitutional amendment to ban coastal oil drilling in Florida waters, to put that in the Constitution. And it's combined with a measure to ban indoor vaping.
Explain vaping.
Vaping is artificial cigarette smoking. It doesn't burn tobacco. It heats up a chemical and delivers nicotine or whatever chemical that you want to ingest.
So when you see someone vaping, it looks like smoke, but it's really just water vapor.
That's right. It looks like smoke, but it's not. Water vapor comes off. You see a cloud of it. It disappears.
Why do they want to ban indoor vaping?
Well, people don't like it because they say it's still projects some of that chemical, whatever chemical it is, usually nicotine, out into the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Now, the question is, what do these two have to do with each other? That's one question.
And which one is the more popular? Because it
seems like the oil drilling ban is certainly popular. The vaping ban is likely to be popular too, but the question that's been raised here, why should a measure like that even be in the Constitution? Now, the ban on cigarette smoking or tobacco smoking is also in the Constitution, but it wasn't initially. The Florida Indoor Clean Air Act was passed 7 or 8 years prior to a constitutional amendment that put the same measure into the Constitution. So such a measure can survive without being in the Constitution. So why do you need to have vaping in the Constitution? And there are a number of other provisions that some people say don't need to be in the Constitution. They could be done by statute.
Right. Well, the whole process sort of is, some people would question the whole process and say, why isn't the legislature working on these things? But the strange thing about that vaping issue is that you would think, well, maybe the Petroleum Institute, since it would confuse the issue, a ban on offshore drilling is popular, and this would confuse the issue. Maybe the Petroleum Institute would be you know, in favor of that bundling. But from what I've read, they don't understand it either. Those lobbyists were just as confused as everyone else.
Exactly. And I don't see a particular political interest being served in that one as the way we talked about on the education bundle.
Right. So there's also going to be a proposal to ban greyhound racing.
That's the only standalone amendment that was proposed by the commission itself. Mm-hmm. It was pushed by State Senator Tom Lee.
And the problem with dog racing is that?
Well, the problem with dog racing is that it's an area that's very vulnerable to charges of abuse, animal cruelty. The dogs are sometimes drugged. They're sometimes mistreated. They're bred for racing and put down in many cases if they can't win races. It used to be, obviously, one of the big things that Florida was known for. People would come down here from up north to go to the dog races.
Greyhound races, Hi-Li.
It's become increasingly unpopular and increasingly disliked by animal rights activists.
Right. And as you see these greyhound dog rescue groups, and they've become much more visible. You see them at farmers markets and things with the greyhounds there. I think they've gotten a lot of sympathy.
I actually own a rescue greyhound.
Justine!
I do, yeah.
He or she?
She. Her name is Tiki. We rescued her just last year through a local rescue here in Tampa Bay, and she was part of the prison training program, so she spent about 2 months at Hardy County Correctional Institute, where an inmate trained her after the track on some basic obedience, and they had a graduation and everything, and we
Great
brought her dog home.
Aw.
But if that ban goes into effect, there are going to be a lot of dogs who are... I think the rescues will be overwhelmed.
What's their personality like, a greyhound? Are they super hyper?
Oh, not at all. They're couch potatoes after racing. Yeah, they're very calm, very lazy, very sweet, quiet. Some of them are nervous. Ours is definitely a couch potato.
So I guess you would be voting for the ban.
I'm not sure. Sharon Wynn from the Tampa Bay Times wrote an interesting story sort of examining the people who've done a lot for these dogs that come from rescues and also racing businesses and families. So I think it's not a cut and dry answer of what is the better outcome for the dogs.
Really? It seems like it would be. So the argument for not instituting the ban would be what?
I think that some of the rescue groups have very wonderful, longstanding relationships with the racing businesses that breed and race these dogs. And like any other industry, like horse racing, there are better owners than others, and I think some have owners who care for them and take care of them and others don't. But I do think that there is a fear in the rescue world that if this ban goes into effect, there are going to be a lot of dogs that won't be able to find homes, and that might be a worst-case scenario.
Interesting. I'm Robin Sessingham, and you're listening to Florida Matters. We're taking a short break, and we'll be right back. This is Florida Matters. I'm Robin Sessingham, and it's our monthly Reporters Roundtable. Here in the studio with us is William March, who covers politics for the Tampa Bay Times, and Tampa Bay Times health reporter, Justine Griffin. Justine, Tampa businessman and strip club owner Joe Redner has been in the news lately. Redner is in remission from lung cancer, and his doctors say marijuana juice is what he needs to stay healthy, and he wants to grow his own.
He does.
So explain what happened next.
Joe Redner is a character from Tampa that has been in the news quite a bit over his lifetime here in Tampa, both for his business and his causes. And so he is in remission from stage 4 lung cancer. And he has a recommendation from a certified doctor in Florida that says juicing marijuana, juicing the buds from the plant, is the best way for him to use marijuana as a form of medicine. But the way that the law is written and the way that the health department regulates it, Floridians are not allowed to grow their own plants. And Mr. Redner challenged that in court, and he said that the amendment says nothing about the whole plant, and therefore he should have the right to grow it on his own. So it went to a short trial in Tallahassee, and the judge ruled in his favor. So
this is Judge Karen Gevers.
Yes.
In Leon County.
Yes.
And what was her reasoning?
reading her order was really interesting. And I wouldn't say that she was sympathetic, but she saw where the problems are for patients. That the way the industry is set up right now, it is not easy for someone who may be taking prescription painkillers but want to try something else, an alternative that's not necessarily as addictive as oxycodone. It is not easy for someone to go see a new doctor that they don't know, pay that fee, pay the state fee to register and to get a license card, go to the dispensary, kind of just like any medication, it takes time to figure out what dosage works for them and what type works for them. It can be very expensive, very time consuming. I've talked to patients who've driven literally across the state to see physicians because there aren't enough to treat the 100,000 plus patients here.
So does Judge Givers feel that the state really hasn't enacted the spirit of the amendment that was passed?
Absolutely. I mean, the amendment passed sort of overwhelmingly. Floridians voted to pass this, and it's been a long, slow process getting it off the ground. What I thought was pretty telling was how she targeted the health department's long inability to actually put rules in place for physicians, for dispensaries, for even patients on what's allowed and what's not. And she said that until the health department can set a strict set of guidelines that Mr. Redner has the ability to use the plant how he needs to and how his doctor recommends. So the health department has since appealed, but the judge also lifted a stay. So because it's a government agency, there was a stay put in place, which meant Mr. Redner could not grow his own plants while the appellate court proceedings were in play.
She lifted that stay.
She lifted that stay, but the health department filed an emergency injunction to put it back in place. And that's sort of where the case stands now, is now Mr. Redner's attorneys are trying to keep the stay lifted through the appeals process.
So interesting how this whole process works. So would he plant a seed that he got from somewhere? I mean, would he be able to legally go buy plants now that the stay is lifted from somewhere?
Yeah, so absolutely. Once the stay was lifted, he had the right to have a plant in his house
and
or on his property.
Find a plant seller.
Yes.
That's already out there.
And what's been interesting about this case is a few of the dispensing companies have come out to support him in sort of an indirect way. Sutera Wellness, which is one of the licensed manufacturers, released a statement that said that they support patients who want to grow their own plants and would be willing to sell plants to mm-hmm. patients, which at this point is not legal, just like how smoking actual flower of marijuana is not legal, which John Morgan is going to trial to fight next month.
So I guess what the Department of Health is opposed to is the unregulated nature of people just growing their own. It's kind of like, I have a prescription for oxycodone. I also know some chemistry, so I'm just going to go ahead and make my own oxycodone, but only for my own use. I'm not going to sell it to anyone else. I'm just going to go ahead in my kitchen and make my own oxycodone. You know, it sort of takes the power away from the state and gives it to someone just to grow their own or make their own.
Exactly. So a recommendation is for something like that is pretty loosely defined. I think it would be very difficult for the state to regulate something like that. But it is the way that it's just the way that medical marijuana is going. If you look at states like Colorado and California, where it is also recreational, it's much more cost effective from a patient standpoint. Obviously, health insurance doesn't cover medical marijuana. It's cheaper to grow your own plant than, say, spend a couple $100 at a dispensary filling your recommendation every month.
Right. And it's kind of hard to follow the logic of why limiting the number of businesses that can grow marijuana when you don't limit the number of pharmaceutical companies that can produce other possibly dangerous drugs or medications.
That's a very good point. And so if there were more companies supplying more dispensaries with marijuana, I bet the price point would be much lower.
So William, Governor Scott made it official this month. He's running for United States Senate. Would he be one of the few Republican bright spots in 2018?
Well, he is a major bright spot for Republicans looking at the Senate as a whole. This will be by far the toughest reelection test that Bill Nelson has had. He had comparatively weak opponents in his most recent two reelections.
How long has he been in office?
He will be seeking his fourth term in the Senate. Prior to that, he was in Congress and was insurance commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
So Rick Scott, of course, is starting off his campaign making term limits one of his major issues, claiming that term limits should apply to members of Congress as they do to the state legislature and other state officials.
Mm-hmm. What's another theme of his for this election?
Well, he's obviously an ally of President Donald Trump. He backed Trump in the primary initially. He didn't actually endorse him formally until after the Florida vote, but prior to that, he exhibited pretty strong favoritism toward Donald Trump. So Democrats unquestionably will try to make Trump a major part of the campaign, try to make Scott's alliance with Donald Trump an attack point for him. Oil drilling will also be an issue. Governor Scott has come out opposed to oil drilling in the Gulf. Democrats will say that that's inconsistent, that it's a flip-flop from when he initially took office as governor.
And Vern Buchanan is facing the biggest challenge that he's seen in years. The Republican from Longboat Key is being challenged by a Siesta Key attorney, David Shapiro, for the 16th Congressional District.
Well, David Shapiro, the Democrat, is clearly an underdog in that race, but maybe not as much of an underdog as Vern Buchanan would like in order to feel comfortable. And Buchanan is clearly feeling the heat. Part of this is because Buchanan's son recently lost a special election for a state House seat, a state legislative seat, in a district that overlaps with Vern Buchanan's congressional seat. And Democrats considered this defeat of his son to be a major indication of what they're calling the blue wave, a surge in Democratic enthusiasm. Buchanan, it's hard to see him as being really vulnerable, but he's not taking any chances. He recently did something he's never done before, which is he started very early on it. He's doing an advertising buy in the Hillsborough County part of his district. Hillsborough is about a third of his district, and it's been newly added to his district, so he's not as well known to the voters there as he is in Sarasota.
Okay. Yeah, and Shapiro's raised quite a bit of money.
Shapiro has done well in fundraising, but he will never, it's impossible to imagine him getting close to Buchanan in fundraising. Buchanan, in addition to that, is a mega millionaire who could spend millions of his own dollars on the race if he wanted to.
That's William March. He writes about politics for the Tampa Bay Times, and health reporter Justine Griffin of the Tampa Bay Times is also here. Thank you both for being here.
Enjoyed it, Robin. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
We always want to hear from you, and there's lots of ways to reach us. You can tweet us at Florida Matters or leave a comment on WUSF's Facebook page. You'll hear more of this conversation on our podcast, Florida Matters More. You'll find a link to subscribe on our website, WUSF.org, or search for Florida Matters More wherever you get your podcasts. Florida Matters is a production of WUSF Public Media. The engineer is Richard Jimenez. The producer is Stephanie Colombini. I'm Robin Sussingham. Thanks for listening.